Hey, Lenny.
Hi, Nancy.
Welcome to episode 74 of the Front Porch Book Club.
The Front Porch Book Club is a podcast that meets twice a month.
We like to dig deep into the relationship between characters and the worlds they live in.
So grab your book and iced tea and join us on the front porch.
Today, we interview Dr. Sarah Brennis about The Shadow of the Wind. Sarah joins us from Madrid for this interview, so it is sort of a long-distance chat on the front porch. She is a professor of Spanish at Amherst, and her research centers around the period of the Spanish Civil War and the Franco dictatorship. Specific to our book this month, The Shadow of the Wind, she has studied the implication of this novel on Spain's collective historical understanding of itself.
Well, she's extremely knowledgeable, and we were very, very fortunate to have her as our guest because her knowledge shed a whole nother layer into the characters because of what they were going through and what their culture was going through and religion and their relationships with one another. So it really helped to enlighten for me a book in a whole new way.
Absolutely. I hope that anyone who has read this book or plans to read this book listens to this interview because it just deepens your understanding of what's happening in this book.
You know what? I would have loved to have had all of this before I even read the book.
Agreed.
So if you're thinking of reading the book, listen to her first and then you'll appreciate so much more what's going on.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's get to it. Welcome, Sarah, to the front porch.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're just so thrilled to have you here and have so many questions about the setting of The Shadow of the Wind, which we know that you, as a scholar of post-war Spain, will be able to help us understand. But before we get started, what led you to a career as a Spanish professor and researcher?
I spent my junior year of college in Madrid, where I am right now. Actually, I'm talking to you from Madrid, and I spent a year abroad here. And I had some host brothers that took me around to all the clubs and discos in Madrid. And actually, they were gay. And so they took me to gay clubs in Madrid in the 1990s. Wow. And frankly, that was kind of my portal into what an interesting culture. And also, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but Spain really changed radically in the 80s and 90s and had a dictatorship up until the mid-1970s. So the period that I first encountered Madrid and Spanish culture was really kind of a transition into democracy. And I just became really fascinated by the history and the culture of Spain, the novels. And I knew whatever I did in my life, I wanted to be able to keep coming back. Maybe not to the discos. I can't quite cut that. But keep coming back to Spain. So that's what led me here.
That's great. What was it that led you to say, wow, I'm going to take my junior year and study abroad?
I started Spanish in middle school, like a lot of American students do. You know, I don't have any family heritage, but I had some great teachers in middle school and then particularly in high school. I loved my Spanish teachers in high school. And when I got to college, I knew I wanted to study for a year and try to immerse myself and push my language just to that next level. And so I majored in Spanish in college, in part so that I could come to Spain for a year. But yeah, it was just the good old public school system, Madison, Wisconsin. That's where I learned my Spanish.
Oh, I love that.
I know people that have done that. And it seems like once you live there, then you really learn it. Is that true?
It's amazing. I mean, because there are more English speakers abroad, but even 10 or 20 years ago, there weren't as many. And you couldn't just throw in an English word and expect people to understand what you were saying. So I really had to find ways to communicate. And that's exactly what does it to your language abilities. You have to be able to communicate. You have to be able to figure out how to describe something without even knowing the word for it. And it really brings it to the next level. It's amazing.
That's great. Neither Lenny nor I knew much about Spain during and after World War II. In fact, we really surprised ourselves by how little we knew.
I'm not surprised. I be surprised you didn't know much. I didn't know anything. I didn't even know there was a dictator there until what you said, 1970 something.
Yeah. Franco, Linda. I don't. You recognize that?
No, I don't know that name. Okay. I don't know what's going on in Spain.
Okay, so here's my question for you, Sarah. And you're a professor, so you also are working with students who are just out. Is it just us, or is it our impoverished educational system in the United States that we know nothing about Spain?
No, it's not you. It's not you. I mean, it's not really even the school system. I mean, if you watch Saturday Night Live in the 1970s, you probably knew who Francisco Franco was because there was a running joke that he was still not dead. He was on his kind of mortal coil for a while in the early 70s. But no, and in particular, the relationship between Spain, the Civil War, World War II, very few people know a lot about that. And yet it's an amazing, it's such a rich history. And it's also really consequential for even, you could arguably, the moment that we're living through now with Europe and the rise of fascism and the far right. But no, no one's going to blame you for not knowing this history before you cracked open the Shadow of the Wind.
Yeah, I was thinking, why as Americans do we know so little about Spain? And I wondered if it's because, for instance, we were not directly involved in the Spanish Civil War like some countries were.
Right. And I think it also depends. The Spanish Civil War, the rest of the world was neutral, essentially. But mm-hmm. there were Americans who fought. They volunteered and went to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade was a group of American volunteers, many of whom came from New York, came from the East Coast, but others from the Midwest, from the West Coast. And these were young men who went, and many of whom died in Spain fighting against fascism. So it does touch us. It does touch U.S. history. And I think that's, in that sense, it's really, really interesting. But it's funny, unless you have kind of a direct connection to it, maybe you don't learn about it in school, although I would make the argument that you should.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. And it seems like it's only recently that people have really started being tourists there. And by recently, I mean since Franco's death. It was really only in the, 90s or this century that I really started hearing about people going there and loving to visit Madrid and Barcelona.
Yeah. And Spanish tourism has just exploded since the end of the dictatorship. But actually, what's interesting is that there were tourists from outside of Spain, people who were traveling from Europe and the United States, even while there was a dictator in Spain. And part of the reason was that Spain was recovering from a civil war and trying to build its infrastructure, build back its economy. And one of the ways it did that was tourism. So Spain got marketed to come sun yourself in your bikini on our beautiful beaches, even though Spaniards themselves were not really able to do that because of some of the moral codes that were operating during the dictatorship. So Spanish tourism actually started to take off in the 60s and then just exploded in the 90s. And now it's off the hook. It's really gone to another level.
Yeah. So in terms of the book doesn't go into detailed or specific explanation about the political, cultural, and religious context of Danielle and his journey. In much historical fiction, it seems like the reader learns a lot about the issues that are going on. So our author, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, either assumes his readers already are familiar with the history, or he simply decides he's going to focus on the story and the characters. Can you give us a mini lesson on Spain's turbulent transition from monarchy through the Francoist regime? Is that too much?
Absolutely. I can do my best. So
at a junior high level.
I'm just saying
for me, because I'm going to actually take notes, Professor, on what you say.
let me see if I can do it. So imagine that Spain in the 1920s is a pretty turbulent place, in part because the Franco dictatorship, which we'll get to, was not the first one that happened in the 20th century. There was another dictatorship, Primo de Rivera, who was a dictator during the 1920s. It wasn't quite as rigid a dictatorship. It wasn't quite as difficult. But so there's a lot of political upheaval in the 20s and the early 30s. There was a monarchy, as you mentioned. But by the early 30s, Spain was trying to come to terms with being a more modern nation. It had been very, very agriculturally based, small towns where there were no schools or really no running water.
Wow.
Some small towns in Spain were really quite backwaters. And then the industrial cities like Madrid and Barcelona were more modern, but still a lot of the schools were controlled by the Catholic Church. And a lot of rich people held on to a lot of the land. And then poorer people were the ones working the land. So there was a situation of pretty deep inequity in Spain in the 20s and 30s. So early 1930s, Spain brought about a republic, which was essentially a democratic form of government. The king took off. He went into exile because it really wasn't compatible to have a monarchy with a democracy. And Spain's Second Republic, this was called the Second Republic. The first was back in the 1800s. And the Second Republic was really a transitional kind of government because Spain began to invest in secular education, meaning that the Catholic Church did not control teachers and classrooms. People took down the cross from the classrooms. It became a more sort of liberal way of teaching, not liberal politically, but more kind of open-minded way of form of education. Women got a whole bunch more rights, you know, right to be able to work outside the home, right to be able to marry who they like. We got a lot of new rights under the Second Republic. And then there was a big land reform, which meant that poorer people who had been working the land were able to actually start to own some of their own land, really try to increase their wealth, and maybe try to make up for some of that inequity. But you can imagine that a lot of people were rubbed the wrong way by that pretty radical transition into democratic reforms. And those people included the military. They were unhappy because their strength was really reduced during that period of time. The church was extremely unhappy about the republic. And then folks who had before been sort of rich and upper class because a lot of their kind of powers were getting stripped from them. So in 1936, a group of generals, military generals, decided to rise up against the democratically elected government. And those generals were led by Francisco Franco, whose name would then become synonymous with the dictatorship. And Spain was thrown into a civil war. You know, a civil war is literally brother against brother, family against family. So there were families who were just sliced down the middle, people who were in favor of the democracy and people who were against it. And it was a really awful, bloody war. It lasted 3 years. And as we said, the international community really didn't get involved, except for some volunteers. Those volunteers were really important. But that civil war, in retrospect, we can see it as really the beginning of World War II, because it was a war against fascism. And in Spain's case, fascism won. So Francisco Franco, who had some help from Hitler and Mussolini, names we probably are familiar with from the Second World War, won the war. He just outmatched the Republic and their volunteers and their militias. And so in 1939, when the war was over and Franco declared victory, Spain began a very long period of dictatorship. So Franco was the only leader. There were no political parties. If there were elections, they were fake, basically. And Franco thrust the country into a complete sort of moral whitewashing, which is to say that the Catholic Church was back in charge. And women no longer had the rights that they had. And school kids were back to learning Catholic doctrine. The country really went kind of almost back in time toward a period where it was really unequal. And a lot of people were really devastated by the war that had just happened. So the 1940s and especially the 1940s, which is a period that you see in the book, Spain has been bombed out. People are starving. There's no work. And people who were supporters of the side that lost have really suffered a lot of violence and kind of retribution, you could call it, for having been against Franco. So that brings us to where the book is really based in that time period.
That's really helpful. And I guess arguably you could say that it was that experience working with Spain that helped the Nazis start to issue some of the agreements that it made about not having a military and started to build their military strength and strategy. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And there's a really famous example, which is the Basque town in the northern part of Spain called Guernica. Oh. Pablo Picasso painted a really famous giant portrait of the destruction that happened. The Nazis, the Condor Legion, which was their air force, bombed that town, bombed the civilians on market day during the Spanish Civil War. And it really was a dry run for World War II. It was Hitler testing out his military muscle. And Mussolini did the same because there were Italian troops that came to Spain and fought with Franco against the Republic. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
This is fascinating to me. When you have the culture that Daniel is coming in, I'm a little blown away here because I'm starting to understand him better. And the life of am I saying it right? Fruin?
Fermin, yeah, Fermin.
Oh, Fermin. Yes, Fermin. So there's some secrets. You know, the author's keeping some things back because we're not understanding these stories, but there are certainly some secrets that some of these people are having in their lives. And I'm wondering, with the brother against brother war, do you think it came from that, like people not trusting their neighbors?
Absolutely. And you have to remember, so this is another important context for this book. Barcelona was staunchly in support of the Republic, of the democratically elected government during the Civil War. And as a consequence, they resisted till the very end and were heavily bombed. The city of Barcelona was heavily bombed. And so when Franco won the war, you've got a lot of people still in Barcelona who support the Republic and who are now enemies, essentially, of the country that they're living in. So in terms of this kind of neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother, you have a culture where there are people informing on their neighbors. There are people who are secret police. There are people who are secret resistors. So there's sort of a post-war conflict that keeps going in Barcelona, in part because the city was devastated, but was also so staunchly in support of the democracy that it's still trying to get rid of the dictator. Some people are. But then there's a lot of military presence and police presence in Barcelona in those years after the Spanish Civil War to try to tamp down on the resistance, the people who are still trying to see, particularly if they can get rid of Franco. And when World War II is happening, World War II ends in 1945, and there's a renewed hope at that point that the international powers, the Allies, will come solve the problem in Spain, get rid of their fascist dictator. And that never happened. So people in Barcelona continue. Again, this dictatorship lasted from 1939 until 1975.
That is amazing. And I'm thinking about Fermin because his history is a little foggy to me. But now that I'm hearing you, it seemed like he was some kind of a spy or something. I don't know, double agent. I guess during the Spanish War.
Yeah.
And then there's this evil cop that rises in power. And I'm wondering if there was corruption. I'm assuming in a war situation that the structure has disintegrated and there's power amok. Am I getting this right?
Absolutely. I mean, not only corruption, but just lawlessness, even within the ranks of the police and the government. Especially because there's this sense of vengeance. After the Spanish Civil War, if you were against Franco, look out, because you know you could be thrown in jail, you could be shot. People don't know this, but there were concentration camps in Spain. They weren't used to gas people like Jews during the Holocaust, but they were used to imprison political opponents and enemies of the dictator. So it's a sense of, you really need to watch your back in post-war Barcelona, because if you are not really openly going to church, wearing the right moral clothes, sort of dressing properly, following the rules and regulations, even speaking Catalan. So in Barcelona, the local language is Catalan, which is actually a different language than Spanish. But that language was prohibited during the post-war. People were not allowed to speak their own language or read books in their own language. And so behind closed doors, you have a situation where people are trying to keep some of their local culture alive, but you can't even speak your own language on the streets of Barcelona. You'd get thrown in jail, you'd lose your job, and there could be any means of repression. It is really a lawless, repressive state.
A lawless time. And that makes me think of the baker down the street. I can't remember if he was really just trans, or maybe people didn't even have the words back then to even say, but there was something different about him. And I didn't realize until you're speaking now of why that happened. The church is now forefront. There's laws against all of these things. There's less tolerance. And a strong military backing. And here I just thought it was like the evil person and the run amok gang of cops that were out there doing this. But this was really more a part, I guess, of the government or permitted.
No, absolutely. And the Franco regime, the Franco government went hand in hand with the Catholic Church. So the most stringent rules of morality, you could not be openly gay in post-war Spain. That was amoral. You had to be married by the church, and you had to be married to have relationships, right? All those sort of very heavy-handed Catholic doctrine. It wasn't just, well, go to church and you'll be fine. It was really your livelihood depended on following those kinds of regulations. And so there were a lot of people behind closed doors, again, as you're talking about the LGBTQ community in Barcelona was completely hidden. It existed, but it had to be hidden for people to be able to keep their jobs and their families.
And now I understand Fermín so much better, because he's completely tolerant. Right. He's very sympathetic to the baker. He's happy to go get a prostitute for the person in the insane asylum. Like, he is very tolerant and he's very loving and kind. He accepts people just the way they are.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that struck me about the novel, is that it's really showing you the underground resistance in Barcelona without explaining it to you. It's showing you that people were resisting those kinds of repressive elements. They had to do it very secretly. And they had to do it in ways that were maybe not obvious to the man on the street. But Barcelona was a seat of resistance against the Franco dictatorship all the way through until the end. And it's still quite a politically left city, that a progressive. And a lot of that is sort of its legacy of having maintained its resistance against the dictatorship during those really, really difficult and dark post-war years.
Now, I would have imagined too, this out of wedlock pregnancy and people having sex. Now I appreciate even how much more of a taboo that was, not only in Daniel's time, but then in Julian's time. And how it's just even hard to say, but she was left to basically bleed out. I mean, it's horrible. It did get better in Daniel's time. He falls in love and he marries the lady that he and her get pregnant. Right. Yeah. But it helps me to understand the family facing this and the children doing what they want.
And it's such a moral code in Spain. And it has been. Right. You know, Spain, this is where the Inquisition happened. This is a place that has followed Catholic doctrine for a long time and has this code of honor. So even if your child becomes pregnant out of wedlock, that is a stain on the family in this Catholic dogma. So this kind of situation doesn't just affect Daniel, it affects everyone around him. And it's almost like when you have one of those moments of resistance or transgression, you could call it, it could infect anyone, right? So people are very careful. And that situation about an out-of-wedlock pregnancy is a really serious moral transgression during post-war Spain. And the book really paints that tragically, but quite honestly.
Yeah,
I was really surprised to read that there were book burnings also in Spain. And I wondered if that in some ways was reflected by the idea of the cemetery of lost books, that here is this knowledge, here are these writings that have been suppressed. What was your take on the cemetery of lost books and how that might have fit into the Spanish Civil War and the Franco regime?
Yeah, I kind of thought of that as part of what happened after the Spanish Civil War was there was a complete brain drain in Spain. People who were intellectuals, teachers, artists, they left. If they could, they left because they saw the writing on the wall that a dictatorship was not going to be a place where they could publish and write and even think freely. So I almost see that cemetery of lost books as almost the place where all that could have been in post-war Spain, all that knowledge, all that creative output that was lost because of the dictatorship, it's kind of symbolically in this lost library, you know, a lost bookshop, a place where these people still made these artistic creations that they just did it in other countries. And it took a long, long, long time for Spain to recover from that brain drain. And arguably, it still affected Spain. A whole generation of Spaniards left, and their families left as well. That and the site of Barcelona, where you have a culture and a language that's prohibited, where people can't write books in Catalan. They can't publish. They certainly can't publish things that are critical about the dictatorship. There's a very strong censorship operation in Spain's post-war, meaning that there's actually like armies of people crossing things out of books. You want to try to get your books published, it has to go through the censors, and they'll take out anything that even remotely refers to the Spanish Civil War or the conflict. I feel like the author, Ruiz Zafón, is really tangling all those different elements into this bookstore and the library and beautifully kind of representing it as a symbol.
That's so interesting because that does symbolically then add a whole nother layer of meaning to the fact that Danielle and his father own a bookstore and that it used to be a very bustling place. And really, by the time Danielle takes it over in the epilogue, there are fewer and fewer people coming. So it's that gradual loss of creative output and also interest in what authors are writing because it's so censored, probably.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Another theme that we thought was really interesting in The Shadow of the Wind was that wealth and status are fleeting during this time. So many of Julian's wealthy school friends end up seeing their wealth and status evaporate during the time of this novel. One of Julian's chums, Miguel, despises and purposely fritters away his father's wealth because he believes it was a fortune tainted by warmongering. And of course, then there's the Aldaya family who disappear from Barcelona and lose their wealth as well. Tell us about the economic upheaval during this time. Who were the winners? Who were the losers?
Well, it's really interesting that question because, first of all, going back to Barcelona, Barcelona is an industrial center. Before the Spanish Civil War and after, Barcelona's industrial base is textiles, but it's a place where fortunes are made, you know, and there is a really rich upper class in Barcelona before the war, and there continues to be an upper class after the war. The upper class after the war are Francoists, are Franco supporters of the regime.
Oh, but okay.
You also have a generational divide. So people whose families, whose parents have made money off the backs of people who lost the war, their children might not necessarily have the same political beliefs and may feel much more stifled by the dictatorship than their parents do. I see that kind of rejection, saying, well, this is money made from the war, as being pretty common for a next generation of people who grew up in the 60s and the 70s to that extent, really rejecting that kind of status and wealth of their parents because they know that it's built on having been complicit or having been agreeable with the regime. But, you know, and Barcelona also is going to go through a major transformation of its economy. We were talking about tourism because Barcelona, as you round into the 60s and 70s, begins to become a really different place that's not as blackened by industrial smoke. And it becomes more associated with its beaches and its beautiful architecture. And that gives you a foreshadow of what Barcelona is today. Barcelona, by 1992, hosted the Olympic Games.
Right.
And that was a really important moment when the city transformed and started to look a little more outward toward international tourism, toward international investment, and then brought about another boom for that city. So it's interesting to kind of think about the economics of a city that, when the post-war was bombed out and had people streets, to a place a few decades later, toward the end of the 20th century, that's going to experience this incredible resurgence because of the Olympic Games and because it's turned toward tourism as an economic motivator.
I think you said this, the younger people would have been more liberal, correct? And it's the older, more established. Okay. Because when we're looking at the love story is my favorite part of this book. The two love stories, the younger people are the ones that are like getting together, and there seems to be less of a class issue with them. Whereas their parents are like, oh no, you're not going to marry down to Daniel, or you're not going to marry down to Julian. And the young people really don't care.
Right.
Would you say that's probably true?
Very true. Very true. I mean, those are the divisions that come from the Civil War, where there's a lot of people who are living in poverty and a few people who are living with great, vast amounts of wealth. And that system keeps going after the war. But young people, you know, especially in the 60s, you think about there were a lot of university riots and upheaval in 1968. Those touched Spain, too. University students in particular were sick of being taught according to the regime's censorship, and they were sick of being told how to live their lives. And so, yeah, there was a, what could they do, really? You can't openly protest under a dictatorship. You'd really get in trouble, although some people did march on the streets in Barcelona. But one way to try to protest is with how you live your life. And say, well, I'm not going to conform to those outdated norms that say that I can only date or relate with people of my same class. And some of those barriers start to break down, which is what you see in the book.
Right.
You mentioned prior to the Spanish Civil War that in the Second Republic, women had a lot more freedom. And then that was taken away in the time of this book. What would a life of a woman look like?
Yeah, it's pretty bleak, as we're three women here discussing this.
Yes.
The idea is that a woman is the housewife. The woman's job in Francoist Spain is to take care of the house, take care of the husband, and to have babies and take care of their children. Women had to get permission from either their father or their husband to work outside the home. They had to get permission to get a passport or to leave the country. Instead of a military service, they had a social service, which meant that they had to go to classes to learn, not, you know, university classes. They went to classes to learn how to rear their children and how to keep a clean home. It was really back to what we might think of as the Middle Ages for women in Spain. They lost a lot of rights. And they were expected to be extremely pious, extremely religious, and to keep the moral center of the family. They were the ones who were sort of tasked with keeping everybody in line, making sure everybody acted the right way, went out with the right people, didn't stay out too late, went to church, went to mass, but they themselves really had very few rights.
Wow. Now that really makes me like the women in this book so much better, because we have people that are working outside the home. We have them in different roles and expressing themselves in different ways.
Right. There were certainly women who, because of economic necessity, because, you know, they had to get a job, there were women who worked outside the home, but most of the jobs that were available to women were subservient, right? Like secretaries, nurses. There was a glass ceiling in Spain at that point that was rigidly in place. So anyone who worked outside the home or who managed to do something creative or just sort of advocate for themselves, you know, that's a risk. And it's a sort of a show of that vital interior that we all have when we're made to do something under the patriarchy. And having a dictator is the ultimate patriarchy.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate man in charge. That was Franco. So women who didn't conform to those norms, they had to find different ways for that to kind of seep out. They had to find different outlets for that kind of form of resistance. Hmm.
That really does make me think of Nuria specifically and how she travels to France and how she has a professional life. She is living as an adult single woman under the cover of supposedly having a husband for a while, but he's right. Dead. And then she's living with Julian. I mean, she is really a countercultural character in a way that I didn't realize.
Yeah. And women had to do certain things to be able to get those freedoms. So you have to be sponsored by a man to be able to get a job or as I said, to get a passport. Of course, there were also women who were not attracted to men who were who were gay. And nevertheless, they oftentimes had to find a partner or someone to allow them to live that very rigid life, but to be able to have some modicum of their own sense of self. It's a very, very oppressive time to be a woman in post-war Spain.
Hmm. Wow.
Okay. The Adaya Mansion, which was called the Angel of the Mist. There's a lot of scenes that take place. I mean, we start out, it's a wealthy household. It disintegrates over the course of the time of this book. It ends up spearing somebody. They get thrown out of the window, an evil person. But it almost felt like a character to me in the story as it ages over time and what happens to it. And then it becomes what? Like a
ad agency.
An ad agency. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on that building and did it represent what was going on in society?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. You think about the geography of the city too. So there's the lower part that kind of goes down to the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and then an upper part that is called Tibidabo, which is sort of the mountain that frames the two sides of the city. And people with more wealth tend to live up higher on the mountain in these big palaces and big homes. And to get there, you have to, you know, at that time, take a streetcar to wind through these streets. I love that imagery in the book of the kind of rotting, degrading mansion. And I think the author is also kind of responding to this tradition of noir in Barcelona. It's this kind of gothic, dark. The streets are dark, it's raining all the time, and it's this feature that makes everything feel mysterious and spooky, and it's not coming out of nothing. That's something that has been a tradition in Catalan and in Barcelona and for writers for a long time. I think he's sort of picking up on that. I remember reading somewhere someone writing about, did it really rain in Barcelona?
I actually wanted to know that. I didn't know Barcelona was so rain-drenched.
Okay. It's not that rainy in Barcelona. It's not quite that rainy. It's on the beach. It's on the Mediterranean Sea. So no, a lot of that is just creating that ambiance of this kind of moody, spooky, you know, there was a lot of destruction after the Spanish Civil War. There's one plaza that appears in the book. I love the way the author uses the city of Barcelona, but there's one plaza called the Plaza de San Felipe Neri, which is a little plaza in the Gothic, what's called the Gothic quarter of Barcelona, where there's the cathedral and the streets are narrow and windy and you really can get lost. And in that particular plaza, there were people who were executed during the Spanish Civil War. And so you can actually see on the stone walls of the buildings, bullet holes. You still can. You can go to that plaza today and you can see those bullet holes. I feel like some of that moodiness and the rain is really just sort of a representation of how dark it was and dark and difficult in those early years after the Spanish Civil War. World War II is raging outside of Spain's borders and people are poor and trying to get along. As we talked about earlier, there's a lot of corruption, you know, that people have to turn to prostitution and other things to be able to make ends meet. And I think that the mansion and the other sort of really dark and dreary descriptions really captures in a way that, you know, everybody walking around in their sunglasses and heading to the beach just wouldn't quite capture how difficult it was to be in post-war Barcelona.
This is just opening up so many different thoughts on this book. When the evil guy gets thrown out of the window and he pierces the angel of the mist, like statue on the fountain, I'm wondering if that was also symbolizing that he was a part of sort of the church and the strict government and the fascism, and the angel kind of takes him out at the end. If that's sort of a triumphant of...
Kind of ironic, isn't it, right?
It is. I thought it was kind of, you know, Shakespearean, but now I think there's meaning behind this.
Yeah, I think you could definitely go there. As I said, Spain is the country of the Inquisition, and the Catholic Church has caused a lot of misery in Spain over the years. So I have a feeling that the author, I don't know exactly how he was intending that, but it seems like that's a poetic justice at the end.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering now, is the Catholic Church still the primary church?
It is. It's still the Catholic Church and the Catholic culture is still pretty prominent here, but nothing like it was during the dictatorship. People are not, I feel like they're more sort of follow Catholic culture, celebrating Easter and Christmas and some of, you know, Ash Wednesday, things like that. But it's really young people in Spain today do not go to church even half as often as their parents did. There's no expectation. There are still Catholic schools here, but there are also public schools that are secular. So that has really changed a lot. Although there's always a fight in Spain about how much money the Catholic Church invests in different like libraries, cultural institutions, schools, museums. They have a lot of money and they still have some real influence in okay. Spain. But nothing like what you saw in the book and what you see. It's very different from what it is today.
During World War II, the Pope was really criticized for the stance that he took. What was Rome's official position in terms of the Spanish Civil War and then the Franco regime?
Yeah, the Vatican was wholly on the side of Franco during the Spanish Civil War. The Vatican, in particular, after Franco won the war, was very present in Spain and outwardly so. So, I mean, the Vatican denounced the violence that happened, but it's kind of like denouncing with one hand and making sure things turn out right with the other hand. So there were two or three Vatican councils that actually happened in Spain in the post-war years, and Franco and the Pope had a pretty tight connection. So really, people sort of imagined that there were three pillars that held up Franco society. It was the military, the wealthy, and the church. And the Vatican was very clearly aligned with the Franco regime.
Was Franco a real true believer in the Catholic Church, or was it a political expediency that he realized he needed the church in order to maintain power?
I think a little of both. He lived his life in a fairly ostentatious manner. He had yachts and palaces and all kinds of wealth. But at the same time, he was married with one child, and you saw him at mass, and his wife was dressed in black, and the sort of outward moral codes he certainly followed. But I don't know too much about his inward religious beliefs, but on the surface, he was a good Catholic, and that's what he expected of the rest of Spain.
So one of the things that I learned when I visited Berlin a couple years ago, that it was a mini series on the Holocaust starring Meryl Streep, of all people, that really started the conversation between children and parents and grandparents. Children started saying, well, wait a second, what was your role during that time? What were you doing? Why have I never heard about this? I loved your article in a scholarly journal called Romance Studies about the impact of this book on Spain's reconsideration of itself during this time. Can you tell us a little bit about how this book has shaped Spain's understanding of the Spanish Civil War and the Franco regime?
Yeah, the book came out at a really important moment for Spain's memory of its past. And it's facing the crimes and the violence that happened during the war. Around the time of the publication of the book, people started to investigate mass graves of people who were killed during the Spanish Civil War. There are hundreds of mass graves, arguably thousands, around the country. Because there were no tribunals, there was no jury trial for people who were enemies of Franco. In most cases, they were shot and buried without any cause as to where or by whom. And in the early 2000s, that began to shift. And at that point, you've got children and grandchildren of people who participated or who were victimized during the Spanish Civil War, really asking for answers from their parents and their grandparents and wanting to know more about their history. So I think this book, if anything, is a conversation starter. This book is something that makes you kind of think, well, what was the situation in Spain in that early part of the dictatorship? What was going on? And why were people victimized, or why were they repressed? What was the status? Something that happens as first-person memory fades is that sometimes things in retrospect don't look as bad as they were at the time. So there were people, in the 90s and the 2000s, and there's still people today who say, oh, the dictatorship in Spain wasn't that bad. People really were taken care of, and the police cracked down on a lot of crime. And that's really kind of revisionist. It's not really what happened. It was a country that was very much oppressed. People's liberties were taken from them. A lot of people were outright killed. And I think the novel is really a way to think about that in today's terms. The novel spans a really wide range of time and includes various generations. And that's a really reflection of how the conversation kind of bubbled up again in Spain as younger people started asking questions and started actually wanting to find out what happened to their family members during the war. What side were they on? And in many cases, where are they buried? Those efforts continue today. The Civil War is not as taught in schools as it should be, in my opinion, in Spain. I think that's a really important history. Just like we need to learn about the Civil War in our country, it's important to know about the Civil War here. And I think popular books like The Shadow of the Wind are just a great way, without hitting people over the head with it, to dive into some of the history behind a really great story.
Very much so. It's amazing how creative writing, creative art causes you to delve deeper into the emotional side of a subject and then want to ask more questions like Linda and I have asked of you today.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Well, your knowledge on this book has really helped me to understand the characters better and appreciate what was going on with them. So thank you for that. You're currently on sabbatical in Spain, right?
I am.
Can you tell us what you're working on?
More fun stuff.
Okay.
My current research is about Spaniards who were deported to Nazi concentration camps during World War II, not because they were Jewish, but because they were political prisoners. There's a lot of stories to be told about that history. And so my research while I'm here and what I've been doing for the last 10 years is trying to tell more of those stories so people know more about Spain's role in world history, and so people inside and outside of Spain know more about their own history and how it's connected to our collective history. So that's what I'm doing.
And you have a couple books that we will definitely link in our show notes, but you have one book about that particular subject.
I do. Yeah, I have a book that's called Spaniards in Mauthausen, which is about books and films, photographs and art that Spaniards who were deported to Mauthausen, a Nazi concentration camp in Austria, produced over the last 80 years. And it's an academic book, but some tell me that it reads pretty well.
Very good. So where can people best stay in touch with what you're up to?
You can look for me on my website, sarahbrennis.com, and you can also find me linked through Amherst College, where my day job has me teaching Spanish culture courses.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sarah. This has been very informational and enlightening for me.
It was a pleasure for me, too. I love talking about a good book.
Oh, we loved hearing about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, Nancy, that was very interesting.
So interesting.
She is so knowledgeable. And I love your question where you asked her about the children asking their elders and how the book has influenced or shaped the story of the Civil War. It made me think, too, of World War II, like mm-hmm. you said, and people kind of being dismissive of some of the ways it was.
Yes.
And thinking back, oh, it wasn't really that bad. Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. It was. It just fascinating, the influence. This book just sold so many millions of copies. So not familiar with it myself in the United States, but you can see the impact that this book has had and continues to have with people reading it now.
Yeah. And think of the impact it's had on us. We knew very little about Spain's 20th century history. Why are we not learning about this more?
Well, Nancy, I didn't learn anything. Junior, I don't know that I learned too much. I know I was in the band. I knew how to read music. I'm not sure. I even took Spanish. I think I took 3 years of Spanish. Yeah. I don't remember even learning about the culture in Spain.
Really?
I did get a lot of D's in Spanish, too. So maybe it was covered. I just didn't learn it. But no.
I mean, there is some chance that we were obtuse students and that they tried. But I just do not remember learning about the Spanish Civil War at all. And in fact, I mostly remember learning about Pennsylvania history over and over and over again every year.
We got that really good in the Revolutionary War. I remember in a history book, World War II was one paragraph.
Yeah.
And there was nothing on the Vietnam War.
No.
But our books may have been written before the Vietnam War ended. So that was
probably
could have been probably.
Probably.
Why.
But boy, it does make me think how important it is that students be exposed to the wide swath of history. Not only are you able to draw connections, like you were saying, the connection between Nazi Germany and people reflecting back on that, people reflecting back on the Franco regime after reading this book, but everything that you learn and how narrow a person's perspective is without learning the truth about history and the struggles that people have been through and what people have thought it was willing to fight and die for, and what happens when oppressive regimes take hold. All of this just feels so vital to me that we continue to learn from these stories.
Yeah, we hit the theme over and over and over again. And it seems like every generation needs to learn it in every country. Like, why are we still fighting this?
Yeah.
Okay, Nance. Well, lots to still learn and talk about. Stop by the front porch next time when we will review Carrie Soto is Back, and it's written by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
I've already read this book. It's a goodie.
Fantastic. I have not. I will.
Everyone, thanks for listening. Our website is frontporchbookclub.com.
Our episodes come out twice a month on the first and third Wednesday of each month.
See you next time, Lenny.
See ya.
No he encontrado nada.
Oh.
Lo siento.
Oh.